Hi, Byron.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. I have to say I'm kind of honored to be here with the, I guess, founder and CEO of Blogging Heads. It's a big deal for
me. There's a lot of other things I do, too. I sweep up after work.
You know, you're not in danger from any sort of boardroom intrigue or anything, are you?
No, I actually am now in this with other people. There actually are some investors, but so far they seem to be, like, nice people, so far as I can tell. I do every once in a while. You know, I watch my back, but...
I have been thinking of some ways that perhaps we could increase revenues for Blogging Heads.
Wouldn't be hard, Byron.
Well, I think commercials are kind of a risky thing because, I don't trust people not to click away from me immediately, even if they make, you know, you make them wait 10 seconds. But I was thinking about product placement. You know, there's no reason that I couldn't have a Coca-Cola or a Bud Light or something sitting prominently on my desk.
Excellent idea. I'm gonna do one now. Here, I've got it was the nearest thing handy. I've got the Holy Bible that I just put up, and maybe the, I don't know who publishes that.
That
but
already
maybe
sells
we can get a
rather well.
There.
You do well for Thomas Nelson Current, the publisher.
That is the leading publisher of Bibles,
but,
I think
you know,
you're right.
You know, in the early days of television, I believe the first television newscast in the 1940s was the Camel News Caravan, where the anchorman very prominently smoked a camel, and there were camels all around, and he smoked as he delivered the news. And, the tobacco industry might, go for something like that.
Funny you should mention that, because Eli Lake is seen smoking a cigarette on the most recent Blogging Heads, and, in fact, I highlighted that on the homepage. It's there for all to see.
As if things weren't dangerous enough in Iraq. But see, now that's a revenue possibility. And the last thing I thought of was possibly, is there any reason that we couldn't sell, like, advertising space on our clothing or a hat or something like professional golfers? I think that could
Byron, be I like the way you think, man. Because, you know, I look down and I see there are parts of my clothing that are not occupied by really anything in particular.
Now, look, I've got a white sort of dress shirt on and the collars are open. I mean, you could...
Wasted space. That is wasted space.
Exactly. So I just wanted to put the, we don't get to talk, much in a business way, so I just wanted to throw those out to begin with.
Listen, Byron, this is really what I did this for. I'm going to go now. I've got what I came for. Really, I appreciate that. And, who better to take advice from in terms of becoming big-time media? Because is it or is it not the case that you were on Meet the Press this Sunday?
I was on Meet the Press this Sunday.
You were on Meet the Press this Sunday.
So I got a glimpse of how it's done in the big time, and that's why, I bring that wisdom.
You bring these insights back.
To Blogging
Gratis.
Heads. That's right.
Now tell me, had you been on Meet the Press before you started doing Blogging Heads?
I have to confess that I had.
You had?
Yeah, I was first on Meet the Press shortly before the 2004 elections.
Mm-hmm.
They invited me on to do election analysis beforehand, and it was great, and I've I don't know how many times I've done it since then, but it's been really terrific.
So if you were on it before you did Blogging Heads, it would not be accurate to say that Blogging Heads has catapulted you to stardom then?
I'm sure the producers of Meet the Press are scouring Blogging Heads for new talent, but I have to say that in my case, I was very fortunate that they invited me on before I appeared on Blogging Heads, yes.
But you wouldn't mind if I went around saying that Blogging Heads had catapulted you to stardom, would you?
Well, look, you can't be charged for that.
Right.
That would be fine.
Right. And in fact, it was that's related to what you talked about. Didn't you talk about Scooter Libby on Meet the Press?
Actually, we talked a little bit about Scooter Libby, which was kind of interesting because... I was asked, what's the kind of bottom line assessment for Libby, and I gave a very stark assessment and said, basically, I think he's going to jail because the White House hadn't given any indication that he would, that President Bush would pardon him or commute a sentence or do anything else. And then the next couple of days, I can't really explain it a lot, but I posted something on the corner on National Review Online suggesting that I might say that a little differently now, that I think that there could be a chance that if the federal appeals court that Libby has asked to let him allow him to remain free while he pursues his big appeal, if that court turns him down, then Bush might indeed act to keep him out of jail. Don't know if it'd be a commutation. There's something also called a respite, which is the president can simply order the delay in the imposition of a sentence so that Libby would still be, have a guilty verdict against him, still be headed to jail, but at some later date, determined by the president. So I now think that there's a real possibility, I'm not saying it would happen, that the president would step in to keep Libby from going to jail.
Just because Libby may face real jail time before Bush is about to leave office. And so, well, and so if he wants to keep him out of jail, he would have to act now.
Yeah, I think the White House was hoping that the judge would allow Libby to stay free pending appeal, which would basically keep Libby free for the rest of the Bush administration. And then if the president chose on the way out the door in December 08 or January 09, he could pardon Libby. But Judge Reggie Walton kind of forced the issue by being very stern and saying that Libby really didn't stand a chance on appeal, so therefore he ought to go to jail right now. So, you know, if the judge gets his way, Libby will go to jail within maybe 60 days.
And I assume that if Bush chose not to pardon him even in that event, the logic would be that at this point he's so weak politically that he just doesn't need another hassle, whatever minor blowback he got from the left.
Well, there's two ways of thinking about it. One, yes, he is weak politically, and the Democrats are mad enough at him already. But on the other hand, you think, well, so what? Is he going to make Henry Waxman mad at him? I mean, what does that matter? The flip side is that Bush has alienated so many parts of his Republican base, certainly starting most recently with immigration, that they would like this. And I'm not saying it would move his polls one way or the other, but certainly with his core supporters, I think it would go over very well.
Okay. Well, we'll stay tuned. I know I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep if Scooter Libby did some jail time. Although, you know, a surprising number of people have written letters in his support, including some people that I actually know and would not have suspected of doing this. You know, that whole list of people who wrote letters pleading for mercy to the judge. I guess they had not thought that this would be made public, right?
You know, I think they must have known. Which ones did you find? I thought Leon Wieseltier of the New Republic wrote a letter.
He did.
In Libby's favor. And his letter was one of the few that had some substantial part of the body blacked out or
right.
redacted.
It was a reference to some legal issue that Leon or someone in his family had faced and Libby, as an attorney, had helped out with.
That's exactly right. Apparently, Wieseltier or someone was in some sort of legal jam. It doesn't sound like it was a criminal jam. They were in some sort of real jam. And Wieseltier says he went to, I believe it was Leonard Garment,
right.
the Washington lawyer, and said, you know, is there anything you can do to help me? And Garment sent him to Libby. And according to Wieseltier, Libby listened to his problems, spent a long time working on them, fixed it, made it go away, and didn't charge him a penny, earning the enduring and, I think, commendable loyalty of Leon Wieseltier. So that was just one interesting story in those letters.
And there's a lot of them. It's a long PDF file.
Well, you know, it's
maybe we'll link to it.
It's kind of interesting. It would be like kind of attending your funeral and not dying. I mean, there were a lot of people who got up and gave heartfelt tributes to Louis Libby, yeah. saying what a good man they thought he was. And, look, he may end up going to jail, but those letters didn't come out of nowhere, and I don't think the people wrote them for any sort of personal gain or glory. I think there's simply a lot of people who feel that he's a very fine man.
Yeah, so even if he doesn't get pardoned, I mean, while he's in jail, that'll be a little pick-me-up. He can pull out that PDF file every once in a while.
Well, now that's kind of a snarky thing to say about it, but it was
yeah.
look, it was a good thing, and it was interesting. By the way, there were letters against Libby, urging the judge to, you know, throw him under the jail. Some of those were actually scribbled screeds. They really kind of had an odd sense about them.
Some pent-up and not-so-pent-up anger directed toward Libby and some of his associates over this Iraq thing, I think, yes.
Well, only because it's a way to get at Bush. I mean, you know, in something like this, everything is about the president. So it's just a way to get at Bush, and Libby is the only one at the moment.
Well, actually, I think people have picked out their own special villains and come to you know, I don't think it's just a calculated way to get at Bush. I mean, I think a lot of people do. I myself don't get totally good vibes when I think about Dick Cheney. I got to admit. I mean, and there are people who have a lot of passion, a lot of animus directed toward specific.
Certainly, Karl Rove would fit that category as well. Look, I think as far as the CIA leak case is concerned, and the same thing you can see in the U.S. Attorney's case, there is a certain group of Democrats who believe that there is a coherent Rovian conspiracy beneath all this, And, you know, the fact is, after the investigation of the CIA leak case, you certainly don't see that. And my guess is, when we get to the end of the U.S. Attorney's case, you won't see that either. Because, look, I was, you know, working for conservative magazines during the Clinton administration and saw some of the ways conservatives thought about things. For example, you know, remember Filegate. I mean, Filegate was going to be kind of the key that unlocked the whole thing. Craig Livingstone, of all people, was the kind of key player in some of this. So I've seen the way that mindset works, and people get a little bit unreasonable in these things. And I think that, you know, that's what we're going to see in the end.
It can happen in politics.
It can happen. It's a good, you know,
sadly,
it's an interesting force. It makes for good magazine articles.
Well, if anybody asks whether you and I are capable of filling 10 minutes talking about something we hadn't planned to talk about at all, I guess the answer would be yes, wouldn't it?
10 minutes already gone by and we haven't gotten to our first topic.
Yeah, but you spent the week at this Take Back America thing in Washington, this big rally of progressives featuring the main Democratic presidential candidates giving speeches and everything. And I guess you could say that you ventured into the heart of what you referred to in the title of a book of yours as the vast left-wing conspiracy. Or maybe this kind of event actually isn't the heart of it as you conceive of it, but we can talk about that a little bit.
Well, actually, no, it is the heart of it.
It is the heart
of
it.
By the way, just I got the title from them, not from the Campaign for America's Future, but just from that group of the left who has often used the phrase vast left-wing conspiracy, especially before my book, to describe themselves. I think although we don't chat about it, I think Marcos Melitzas likes the phrase. And as a matter of fact, he started a little publishing outfit, and I believe it's known as Vaster Books, in the sense of making the conspiracy vaster.
Vaster than the right-wing conspiracy.
Yeah, well, you know, and what's interesting is I've been to this conference, which is run by the Take Back America conference, run by the Campaign for America's Future, which is a lefty activist group headed by Robert Borisage and Roger Hickey. I've been to it for, I guess, maybe since 2003, so maybe three or four of them. They are getting bigger and better organized, more professional every year, and I think this one certainly was because, you know, they've, as far as the government is concerned, they've taken back half of America. And I do think that there was kind of the air of smell of success about them this time, which was, to me, wasn't as interesting because I prefer the bitterness and out feelings of being an outcast and all the sort of ugliness that goes on with being losers, which is, you know.
You mean you like the feeling of them feeling like outcasts? What you had this time was the feeling that you're an outcast and you don't like that.
Actually, I'm more interested now in Republican races, so maybe I'm just switching my interest in those feelings. But yeah, I mean, look, they're doing quite well, and it's a well-organized conference. And the interesting thing was is that it is devoted to building this progressive infrastructure, which is what my book was about. I mean, my book started with a chapter on MoveOn.org, which is really maybe the earliest and the biggest of these groups, founded in 1998 during the Clinton impeachment. It becomes a huge internet activist group. It's also a chapter on the Center for American Progress, which is John Podesta's progressive think tank here in Washington. Also had a chapter on on Air America Radio, which is not done that well, although, you know, efforts to break into talk radio are still big on the left. So,
which we plan to talk about later.
We will. That's a tease. We're working on teases now. So I could see a lot of these things getting bigger and bigger through the conferences now. Media Matters, which is David Brock's media watchdog organization, which was kind of midwifed by the Center of American Progress. That's playing a pretty big role in all this. So all of these institutions that they're building, which they modeled on what they thought, their, you know, view of Republican institutions like, or conservative institutions like the Heritage Foundation or Talk Radio or the Media Monitoring, Brent Bozell's group.
Fairness and Accurate. Wait.
Media Research. Media Research. Company.
Yeah.
They modeled it on all these things, and now you can see it really coming into shape. Their own vast left-wing conspiracy is coming into shape pretty well, and you could see that at this conference.
Although, can I interject, are you aware of this book by Matt Bai that I think is not yet out?
I believe it's coming in August. It's called, like, the Argument.
I think his thesis, I think, is that this is failing or has failed, right? Uh-huh. He wrote this big piece, which I guess was in the New York Times Magazine, about several years ago, about the beginning of the building of this liberal infrastructure of influence.
Right.
That was very self-consciously styled after the apparently successful conservative effort to influence opinion. And I think I've heard from somebody who read the book in manuscript that the thesis is that it hasn't worked. But I don't know. It's hearsay, I guess.
I'm certainly aware of the book, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing it. And certainly my book, which came out in April of 2005, was about this failure during the 2004 election. But basically at the end of the book, if I remember, I said, look, they've gotten a start, and they've come along much faster than Republicans did after their, you know, really devastating scrape bottom loss of 1964. And there's no reason that they can't make a lot of progress really quickly, and that people could become very tired of Republicans, and they could find themselves in a very good position. So, you know,
you think they really built a well-oiled machine here, having observed this several years in succession, and you don't think that all that's happened here is that kind of the Bush administration has been a disaster. You think the liberal influence machine building has been successful?
Well, I think, well, first of all the talk certainly was that the Bush administration has been a disaster, but the fact is a growing percentage of Americans are thinking that. That's just, you know, right or wrong, that's their public opinion is moving in that direction. But the other thing is, I think some of these, you know, certainly the Center for American Progress seems to have its hand in lots of things, and is turning into an effective message machine. I mean, in my chapter on them, I really question whether they, a so-called think tank, should be a war room as they were. But nonetheless, they're pretty effective in getting progressive ideas and politicians together. So, yeah, I think they are making progress.
Well, I think part of the conservative model that's being followed is the think tank that is a little more than a think tank, right? I mean,
well, yeah.
The Heritage was not, you know, in its heart of hearts, ideologically neutral, and its publications were, you know, had a purpose.
No, it wasn't ideologically neutral at all. I mean, it was very conservative. On the other hand, it was a little, it was kind of electorally neutral. If you look at most of their stuff, it wasn't as openly advocating candidates as the Center for American Progress. If you look at what the Center for American Progress was doing in the months leading up to the 2004 election, they were really kind of serving as a war room or a talking points factory for the Democratic Party. And so much so, by the way, that the Center for American Progress itself is a 501c3, a tax-exempt charitable institution like the Heritage Foundation or the American Enterprise Institute. But they set up a 501c4, which is a different category, that is able to engage in openly political activity. So the other places don't have that. I don't think Heritage has a 501c4. Hmm. Brookings doesn't have a 501c4. So I think they were always kind of a hybrid institution of an honest-to-God think tank and a political war machine.
Yeah, and I would say Brookings is really in a somewhat different category, really, from either of those, I would say.
Well, that's true. It is
maybe the closest to a truly scholarly institution, in which certainly a diversity of views are represented.
Right. And in fact, Podesta modeled it, to the degree that he modeled it on anything, he modeled it on Heritage. They all looked at Heritage and viewed that as the way one creates an institution.
Yeah. So you were, okay, so you went to this this gathering that you see as a sign of a growing, like, progressive organizational skills or something, and you saw all these presidential candidates, Obama and Hillary and Evans there, right?
I have to confess, they were all there, but I didn't see them all. I had something else to do when Obama and Edwards were speaking.
Okay.
So as far as I understand, they were both very well received, and as you know, in the straw poll afterwards taken of participants there, Obama won the straw poll, Edwards was second in the straw poll, and Hillary Clinton was third, maybe 12, 13 points behind Obama. In other words, kind of perfectly, the perfect reverse of the national polls that have her 12, 13 points.
But in keeping with the idea that the most active, mobilized part of the, you know, the real
That's
activists
right.
are probably
yeah.
more inclined to Obama, right? I mean, it shouldn't, in that sense, it shouldn't surprise us.
No. It wasn't a surprise. It would have been stunning, I think, if Hillary Clinton had come out ahead in the straw poll of this particular organization.
Okay. And you were there. Now, there is this issue, this of the booing of Hillary.
Right, the booing, yeah.
That you reported about, and there's now this is now a subject of contention between you and Bill Scheer, who is also a blogging head, actually, and who I think was the or one of two kind of quasi-official bloggers.
I think he was doing official or officially sanctioned blogging for the Campaign for America's Future, which put on the conference.
Yeah, and you were there at Hillary's talk, and there was some booing, and you reported it as, I mean, here's the big difference, I guess. You report it as beginning when she lauded the American military for
right.
having done its job. He says, no, it didn't start there. It started after she blamed the Iraqi government
right.
for the problem. Now, I got to say, have you gone back to the videotape and listened?
I have looked at the videotape, which doesn't really fit my memory of it, I think because I assume that the audio on the videotape is from the podium microphone, and it doesn't fit. I'll tell you what I remember happening and what's in my notes is that she goes through this long speech, and she gets a very good reaction to all the stuff she says about health care and how bad the Bush administration is and all of that stuff. Very positive reaction. Then, she's got to get to the war sometime. So she gets at it toward the end. Now, the code pinkers in the audience,
what is this code pink thing?
Code pink is I think it's fair to call them a radical anti-war group that is showing up at more and more events in Washington to kind of mildly disrupt them and make their presence known. You've probably seen when Alberto Gonzalez testified in the House and the Senate, there were women in back of him. And they were either wearing pink shirts or a pink hat or something, and they would occasionally just stand up and say, impeach him, or they would have a sign that says, impeach him. The chairman of committees are tolerant of them in varying levels. John Conyers, I think, has wanted to keep them out and not let them disrupt his House Judiciary Committee proceedings. I went to a hearing where Gonzalez testified before Patrick Leahy, Senate Judiciary Committee, and Leahy just let them do whatever they want. I mean, it was amazing how tolerant he was. But anyway, code pinkers are showing up a lot at various things, and they were at this this event, and they were scattered throughout the audience, and they had signs. They had little just pink, 8.5 by 11 signs that said, "Lead us out of Iraq now." I actually did erroneously report that as "Get us out of Iraq." It was "Lead us out of Iraq now." And when she began talking about Iraq, some of them began catcalls, the individual catcalls, like, get out now, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That I did not count as booing. I mean, those were very small groups of people. When she started to talk, and then she said, as many of you may know, I voted against the supplemental, and I think their reaction was, big deal, you voted for the war. But when she got to the part about how the American military has succeeded, it's done its job, it got rid of Saddam, and she kind of listed these Bush's goals for the war, which was to get rid of this tyrant and, make sure there were no weapons of mass destruction and all this.
Right.
You could hear the sort of undertone, and by booing, I mean boo, that kind of stuff. I don't mean the occasional catcall.
Yeah.
And it reached a crescendo when she said that, the American military has failed, it's the Iraqi government that's failed, it's not gotten its act together and done the things it has to do.
Yeah.
At that point, the booing was rather loud, in my view. I was sitting toward the back in on the right, as you face the stage, and what happened was, and you've often seen this happen, the boos were fairly loud, and there were a significant number of people, but they certainly weren't a majority of the people. So the majority of the people kind of decide to start cheering and overtake the boos,
right.
which they did do. I think people may have read my report as suggesting that the crowd was booing the troops or, you know.
Well, that's why this became an issue. And actually, this is an interesting little example of the whole influence wars in Washington that we were describing earlier, in a sense. In other words, the left is trying to build an infrastructure that will help it win the spin wars, among other things.
Right.
And this has become that, because you're right. I think your account, I don't know if only your account, but the kind of thing you emphasize, where you have, when she says the American military has done its job and boos began to be heard around the room, as the boos increased, she raised her voice, the American military has succeeded, she said, to more boos, and then it is the Iraqi government that has failed to make the tough decisions. Still more boos. Now, the stakes here, Bill Scheer says the boos come after she says it is the Iraqi government that has failed to make the tough choices, because these people, and I personally identify with this, are sick of the Bush administration kind of blaming this on the Iraqi people. And there's actually a time in there that would be in the ellipses here where she kind of does say the Iraqis, as if it's the people who are to blame. That's his he wants to stress the liberals here are not booing the American military. They're booing her blaming things on the Iraqis rather than on, I guess, the Bush administration You have the booing beginning earlier, in which case it could be interpreted as being an anti-American military booing. And so it's just interesting that this little point of emphasis becomes part of this larger spin war.
Yeah, it's a small
now, I guess you agree that if you go back and listen to the videotape on Bill Scheer's item, it seems to support his account more than yours. Now, it could be that you know, the microphone was wherever it was. It could be that you happened to be among a group of Hillary derogators,
I was among a rather quiet group.
Yeah, but
let me say one more thing. I think the boos were beginning as she was talking about Iraq and the idea that the American troops had succeeded, and I did not interpret it as a razzing of the American military. I mean, I know that...
Yeah, you did not really spin it that way.
I
couldn't tell if in your piece you were thinking that or not, but then other people picked it up that way.
I was not thinking that, and I didn't write that, and it was attributed to me. On the other hand, I will say that I would guess that most of the people who were brewing, and many of them in the conference in general, would find the idea that the American military had succeeded in Iraq to be preposterous. I mean, if we had succeeded in Iraq, I don't suppose we'd be in the position we are in right now.
Right.
So I'm not sure what they're arguing. I mean, they're very, very sensitive about being perceived as being against the troops. But I didn't write it that way, and I didn't perceive it that way. I perceived it as they are still mad at Senator Clinton for voting to authorize the war, and even though she has been coming to them in little steps and big steps, she's not there yet, and they're still mad at her yet. And so her explanation that American troops have succeeded, it's the Iraqis who failed, was another one that didn't fly with them. I mean, that's the way I interpreted it.
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of puzzling she chose this tack in my mind, because...
It was interesting, wasn't it?
But yeah, I mean, I would think that she knows what group she's talking to, right? I would think it should be all about blaming the Bush administration for not supporting our troops, right? It's fine to say the military did its job as best it could, but you would think that in front of this crowd she would go on to say, but it did not get support from the civilian side in the Pentagon that Bush appointed, you know? I mean, that's really, first of all, I think true in important respects, and secondly, a much easier thing to sell to this crowd than to say, oh, it's the Iraqis.
Absolutely, and this is this is something that you hear from conservatives. I was in South Carolina a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and you know, I was hearing this from Republicans. I mean, they're very unhappy with the way Bush has conducted the war. No one is unhappy with the way the military has performed. They've performed with extraordinary bravery and skill. But the conservatives were saying to me, look, not only did Bush go in with too few troops, they imposed unreasonably restrictive rules of engagement on these troops, and we didn't really allow them to fight the war. Now, that may be a fantasy. That may not hold up under scrutiny, but that's how they feel. So nobody in this debate is saying the troops have failed, but almost everybody in this debate, regardless of where they're pointing the fingers, is saying that the command structure up to the president has failed in this. So, you know, I didn't get the whole controversy about what I wrote. I mean, clearly they were booing this whole idea.
Yeah, but it did seem to me that the formulation of her speech was slightly tone deaf. I don't.
Oh, I would agree with you entirely, especially with who she was talking to.
Right. No, this I can see this in the general election or something.
Yeah.
But so I don't totally get that. I mean, as long as we're on this, this is something I was going to ask you. You know, when you talked about what you hear in conservative circles, how exactly are conservatives kind of assimilating the lessons of the Iraq War? I mean, I don't think that there are many people now who are arguing that this has been a big success. And
no,
when things
no,
are failures,
not.
You have an explanation for them, and sometimes you actually even revise your views
right.
in light of that. Now,
right.
I guess what you've just said is kind of what I would think is the standard kind of conservative, or at least among those conservatives who strongly supported the war, this
right.
is a standard kind of thing you would say. What I was going to ask you about was, when you look at Republican presidential candidates, is there any evidence that they are kind of working this out? In other words, I mean, the larger question is, it seems to me, not that I've actually watched any of the debates, but judging by secondhand accounts, they're kind of competing with one another to win the most hawkish trophy.
Yeah.
But after that, it's all a blur. It's
right.
it's not. It hasn't gotten to the level of them even coming up with any distinctive accounts of what we can learn from the Iraq War. And then to hear some of them, like Giuliani sometimes, you would think they thought that there was almost nothing wrong with the way it worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say anything about is there any difference in the foreign policy positions that are being staked out by the Republican
yeah.
candidates?
Well, as far as the rank and file electorate are concerned, I think there's no way you can really quantify this, but I think a lot of Republicans in, say, 2005 and 2006 just kind of averted their eyes. They hoped things went well. They hoped the president was on the right track. And they didn't like to read all the news that suggested otherwise. That's true. That's not true of supporters of the war like Bill Kristol, for example, who has been very prominent, advocating, you know, more troops for quite a long time and doing stuff like that. But I think in the electorate there were a number of people like that. And there are people who do not want to believe that George W. Bush made a mistake at the get-go by going into Iraq. So you've seen in the Republican primaries all of the candidates supporting the war pretty much in the same way. The only differences were how much credibility you had to support the war. McCain, I think, having the highest credit because of his own military record, the highest credibility to support the war. And then after the defeat in November and the thumping that Bush talked about, you have this change in strategy to the surge, which had bought him a lot of time, the president a lot of time, with his own supporters, because they're saying you've got to give this time to work. And it has been something that politically I think has made Democrats look bad. I believe it was week before last, on a Wednesday, Pelosi and Reid wrote a letter to the president saying flatly that the surge had failed. And on Thursday, the Pentagon announced that the last of the five brigades to be brought into Iraq to take part in the surge had actually arrived. I mean, so they were declaring it a failure before everybody had arrived. On the other hand, if you get to what's going to happen, I think, with the Republican candidates is you will start to see differences come September, and this famous day of reckoning that's going to come in September when General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker present their assessment of progress in Iraq. And I do think at some point you're going to have Republican candidates respectfully peel away from Bush on Iraq. They are respectfully peeling away from Bush on the issue of spending all the time. When Mitt Romney talks about how, you know, I like to veto budget bills. I like a balanced budget. I like to cut spending. I mean, he's saying George W. Bush hasn't done that stuff, and I will. And Republican audiences get the message. They don't want a candidate to get up there and bash the president, but they're happy to talk about a post-Bush world in which some of their Republican values, like fiscal restraint, are respected more than they have been under Bush. So what I think you're going to see come September or October is Republican candidates begin to peel away from Bush on the war.
And I mean, what are the first things you expect to hear them say in particular about, I mean, like that he didn't send enough troops?
Well, they may say it just like Hillary Rodham Clinton said it,
yeah.
Which is that we went over there, we did a magnificent job, we accomplished our goals, we gave the Iraqis a chance, and they have messed around and not gotten it together. They would rather, you know, smite their enemies than put together an oil sharing proposal, and we simply cannot afford to support them anymore, and we need to see if they can stand on their own two feet, and the only way we can do that is by leaving. I think Senator Clinton's explanation was a very good Republican explanation come October.
It was a good Republican. You're right, and that makes it seem all the weirder.
Well, it does.
It's really strange. I mean, it really is strange.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it is so obviously a Republican critique.
Right. Right.
It's kind of what the Republicans are saying. I mean, except for the presidential candidates who aren't yet talking.
And astonishingly, it did not fly with the audience at the Take Back America conference.
Who would have guessed?
Yeah,
who would have guessed?
Right. Send that one back to Hillary land for some further tinkering.
Yeah, I don't know. She's got her share of consultants who should be thinking about these things.
Yeah.
So, am I right that Giuliani in particular, I mean, the little sound bites I've heard from him are just particularly kind of uncritical when it comes to, I mean, he says things like, we couldn't have fought the war on terror without invading Iraq.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess one interpretation would mean that he thinks we're actually better off now than we would have been. And that certainly doesn't survive my scrutiny. Then again, mine isn't typical conservative scrutiny, but certainly at the kind of very least, I don't know. Is he saying the most extreme things in that regard of the group?
Well, the flypaper strategy does hold some sway in some conservative circles that, you know, we're fighting them over there so we don't have to be fighting them over here.
Right.
And so that's not a loser. As a matter of fact, I don't think it'll be a loser at any time. In the campaign, I think the cracks that you're going to see in the coming campaign are about deadlines and troop withdrawal. And the orthodox argument has always been that if you announce a deadline, you simply announce to your enemy, wait until this date and we'll leave, and then you can have Iraq. But I think that people may start seeing the flip side of it, which is, when you announce a deadline, you say to the Iraqi government, you have this long, and we mean it, and we're leaving, and you have to do something about this. Do you understand? And that's what, you know, the American government has been doing a full court press on Nouri al-Maliki in the past few weeks. Within a span of a few days, they had Admiral Fallon, they had John Negroponte, they had Robert Gates in there speaking with al-Maliki. On one occasion in the presence of a New York Times reporter, stressing how important this is. So I think this is going to seep into the campaign after the Petraeus report in September.
Okay. And you've been keeping up with recent events, I gather. You alluded to the most recent Iraq offensive before we actually turned on the cameras.
The Arrowhead offensive. Yeah,
I mean, the idea is they're going to try to do something that traditionally has been hard to do with this offensive, which is, I mean, they're trying to, I gather, you know, part of the resistance the surge in Baghdad is encountering is that somewhere beyond the confines of Baghdad, there is this infrastructure for building, you know, truck bombs and stuff.
Right.
They want to go after that base, and they want to do something that's been hard to do in the past, which is that as they do this full court press on the insurgents, they want to plug the holes so that they actually can't escape and live to fight another day, which they have pretty much always done
you know,
in these
this is,
things.
This is something that is distressing to the conservative supporters of the war. I mean, it's dealing with the whack-a-mole problem in Iraq, whereas if you crack down one place, the insurgents or al-Qaeda, whoever it is, just goes to another place and they take hold there. And now our strategy is to not just chase them around, but to actually kill them. And there are some conservative supporters who are saying, why haven't we been doing that before?
I mean, well, I think we're like in Fallujah, they were trying to kill them, right? The problem is just that there was a place to run. So you killed some fraction of them, and the rest eluded you entirely. You didn't wind up capturing them.
Right, but I think this plays into conservative feelings that they would have rather seen the war prosecuted more aggressively earlier than having to do this under these intense time pressures with a Democratic House and Senate. By the way, did you see the David Ignatius column? I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago that talked about some of the constraints that are placed on Americans in Iraq. I think he was talking about the CIA and bomb makers in Iraq, and they began by thinking, well, there's an absolutely infinite supply of explosives in Iraq. It's everywhere. But there is not an infinite supply of people who know how to make bombs in Iraq. So they come up with this idea to essentially flood the place with booby-trap detonators that go off when they're making the bomb. And which is just one of there may be some terrible flaw in this problem, but it sounds darn clever.
It's a pretty clever idea.
And Ignatius said that CIA lawyers wouldn't let him do it. It's the sort of thing that drives war supporters crazy. Because they feel, and maybe they're wrong about this, they feel that the greater application of force would have resulted in much more success by now. It might have killed more people in the short run, but it would save lives in the long run. And, you know, they're very unhappy with the way the war went. But that's getting back to what we were saying before.
Yeah, and of course the alternative critique, and in a certain sense, I mean, the critique from the, I wouldn't say from the left, but from the less hardline part of military strategic doctrine would be that a failure was not to really implement counterinsurgency doctrine in a subtle way, right? I mean, my favorite example is how right as at the very beginning during the occupation, they would go into these Iraqi houses, drag out a suspected insurgent, put a bag over his head, make him kneel. So his family is out there looking at them. He's completely humiliated, and then they would videotape it and let it air on Iraqi TV, right? Now, that's, I think Petraeus would say, not a good idea.
Right.
And true counterinsurgency doctrine is sensitive to this hearts and minds business, which doesn't exclude, of course, killing bad guys whenever you can do it cleanly. But there is this somewhat different critique of what they did wrong. And in a certain sense, the fact that Petraeus is now in charge indicates that critique has gotten taken seriously, you know, within the Defense Department.
I know. And the angry thing, I guess, is that why did it take this long to get there? But, you know, there we are, and the president did what he did over these years. And as I said, I think we'll begin to see Republican candidates break with him, or begin to break with him, in a respectful way in a couple of months.
Now, what about Bloomberg? Should we be taking this seriously?
You know, I for one, do not understand. I mean, can you show me any evidence that the American public is just hankering for a Michael Bloomberg presidential candidacy?
I can show you evidence that a disproportionate number of people who are influential in the media happen to be in the New York area. Would that help answer your question?
No, it doesn't. Look, we know a few things. I mean, we do know in the latest NBC Wall Street Journal poll, Bush's approval rating, 29%. Congress's approval rating, 23%. The percentage of Americans who think the country is headed in the right direction, 19%. So, people are unhappy. There's no doubt about that. And that could possibly mean that they would be interested in a third-party candidacy. But, you know, in another part of the report, you know, the poll, Democrats have always been, for months now, said that they're relatively happy with the field that they have, Obama, Clinton, and Edwards. Republicans, on the other hand, in the early months of this year, seem to be very dissatisfied with Giuliani, McCain, Romney. Now, however, when the Journal asked the report with those names plus Fred Thompson, 73% said they were satisfied with the field. So I don't even think you can argue that Republicans and Democrats are really upset with their own choices. So where Bloomberg fits in, you know, other than having the ability to self-finance till the cows come home, I don't know.
Yeah, and we know very little about large parts of his worldview, right? Like, do we have a clue on foreign policy?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, look, I think he deserves credit for helping to safeguard and consolidate and extend some of the achievements of Rudy Giuliani in New York. I mean, the city could have started going to hell quickly after the election of another mayor. But it didn't, and so I think he deserves credit for that. On the other hand, if that's your reasoning, why not just vote for the guy himself, Giuliani?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't, you know, I don't see it, and I do know that obviously Perot got a fair amount of support. He got 19% of the vote, which is huge in 1992, although he didn't get a single electoral vote. But as I remember, tell me if I'm wrong, I think in 2000, after the Clinton impeachment, after the Lewinsky scandal, people were telling pollsters they were just sick of this partisanship in Washington. They were absolutely sick of it. And they ended up giving splitting Republicans and Democrats, you know, virtually identically in their votes in the campaign. I just don't see any great desire for an independent candidate, and if there is one, for it to be Bloomberg.
Yeah. No, okay. So let's do dismiss that.
Okay.
And I'm sure this will put an end to all the talk. Now that you and I have said this.
Yes, that's right. He'll have to be mayor for however many more 900 days he has to go.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of the poll showing so little confidence in Congress, is the conventional thinking among actual reporters such as yourself and the kind of people you hang out with in Washington that this may have a certain amount to do with the Democratic strategy of, you know, getting into this Iraq withdrawal timetable business? I thought that was a political mistake. Is there speculation to that effect, that was like is turning out to have been a big mistake on the part of the Democrats?
Certainly Republicans, the Republican strategy after their defeat, the White House strategy was really two things. It was rely on Mitch McConnell to hold the line, stop things in the Senate, and wait for Democrats to overreach. And they certainly felt the Democrats had overreached, especially when John Murtha came out and said, you know, in that interview he had with the anti-war activist organization saying, you know, we're going to kill this surge. So, I mean, there's certainly Republicans feel that the Democratic move against the war is responsible for this. But on the other hand, I mean, you look at all the polls, and people are very supportive of a plan for pullout in Iraq. And I think it's correct to say that Democrats won election, won control of the House and the Senate for this, and for the people, their voters wanted them to get us out of Iraq. So it seems to me that they're actually doing what their voters wanted. I think what may contribute to this feeling is that a lot of the other stuff that they said they were going to get done in 100 hours and then in 100 legislative hours, they haven't gotten done. I think the only thing that has gotten done is the minimum wage, right? So all the other stuff they talked about with, you know, college loans and energy and all the Iraq, the 9/11 Commission stuff, I don't think any of that has actually happened yet. So I think some voters have been quick to say, well, you know, they're just like the other guys, and give them equally low numbers.
Okay, a do-nothing Congress problem.
Yeah. I mean, look, they've only been in office for 6 months.
I say. Give them some time.
They can do nothing even more.
And they're not accustomed to having power either. So we were going to talk a little about this report on talk radio that I guess was a report done by the aforementioned Center for American Progress?
You know, was it done by them or commissioned by them? I think it was actually commissioned by
them.
But it's this is the thing that has always it's kind of baffled me about progressives. I mean, they're obsessed with talk radio, and they think Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity are the source of all Republican power in the world. And they, as you know, for years they tried to come up with their own Rush Limbaugh. Would it be Mario Cuomo? Would it be Jim Hightower? Would it be somebody else? And then they decided, well, we shouldn't really put our hopes on one person. We should start a whole network, create Air America to compete with conservative talk radio. And they've been kind of crazed about competing on this particular battlefield. And I would ask them, you know, I mean, you've got academia and you've got Hollywood and, you know, the New York Times is not nothing. Why does everything have to be so symmetrical? I mean, conservatives are strong in talk radio, but you're strong in other things. What's the obsession with talk radio?
I'm not sure Hollywood is an unalloyed asset personally.
You'd certainly say that people in Hollywood who make movies overwhelmingly support Democrats, wouldn't you say?
Well, maybe. But one thing I'm saying is the association, the idea that you're putting out there, the association of Hollywood types with liberals sometimes hurts liberals.
Right.
That image. And as far as, you know, major newspapers, I mean, certainly on things like the Iraq War, the Washington Post was four square in support of the Bush administration, but both the editorial page and the op-ed page, which run by the same person.
But you would say in most other things, like, you know, healthcare, the
economy, domestic taxes, policy more so. That's
taxes
true.
And all that stuff, I would say they follow a good, solid, moderate Democrat worldview, judges, all of those things.
On domestic policy, I've just been more focused on foreign policy, and there I think it's a mistake to think of the Washington Post as a liberal paper on the editorial pages. But
I mentioned the Times, actually.
Yeah, no, you did. I was just saying the Times is somewhat more liberal than the Post, for sure, editorially. On foreign policy.
But anyway, regardless of those things, the left has been kind of obsessed with developing a real presence in talk radio.
Yeah, it's now you grant the database of this report or the quantitative findings. I mean, they must have had some index for categorizing talk radio as either progressive or conservative.
You know,
and I guess maybe it's not that hard probably tend to fall one or the other pretty clearly, but they had all these bar graphs for different cities, which were interesting in their own right, by the way. I would not have guessed that Chicago had a much more robust progressive radio infrastructure than L.A. or San Francisco.
That's right. Chicago was almost one-on-one.
Right. It was like 53-47 conservatives win.
You know, but Houston and Dallas and Atlanta were virtually zero for progressive.
What you would expect, yeah. Now you don't... That's consistent with your casual observations, right, which is that if you turn on the radio and listen to talk radio, it's probably conservative, right?
Oh, I don't doubt any of that. I mean, I think their findings were 91% of it is conservative, and I can't say whether it's 87 or 92, but that sounds about right. It's certainly dominated by conservatives, yeah.
So one question becomes, I mean, we can get later to the report's analysis and what they propose to do. What is your explanation? Because that's clearly out of proportion to the way the electorate winds up breaking down.
That is. And this has been something, and this report goes after two common explanations for this. And one is that the fairness doctrine was ended, and all of these conservative voices, these immoderate voices, took advantage of that. And the other was that the audience actually prefers that. And I think for whatever reason, conservatives have shown a lot of ability in this. I mean, Rush Limbaugh, who is really the person who started this, is a singularly talented man. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, to think about it, he talks for 3 hours a day by himself, almost never with a guest. And millions of people find that entertaining, I mean, which is just quite amazing, and does it every single day.
Yeah, well, you can focus, you know, you can argue about which aspect of it is amazing, that he does it or that people find it entertaining, but anyway, I'll let you continue.
Well, no, I mean, look, he's quite talented at that, and obviously we pay people, you know, $15 million a year to be on the Today Show, so it's, you know, that's the market in this country. Why liberals do not respond to a liberal message the way that conservatives do to conservatives, I don't know. I can say that I do not think there are any liberal talk show hosts who have the sort of talent and intensity levels of Limbaugh, Hannity, and Ingram that I can be aware of. On Air America Radio, which I listen to a lot for doing my book and sometimes afterwards, Al Franken was not very good. He just wasn't. They have a woman who's quite good at radio named Randy Rhodes, who is hard to take for a lot of people, but she's really quite good at it. But on the other hand, they've never really gotten a big audience. I think talent level is part of it, but why is it that... The other common explanation is that liberals have NPR. I mean, they have other stuff to listen to. Now, certainly not the same message. Limbaugh's is much more entertaining. than NPR is, but, you know, liberals are quite happy with NPR.
Well, wouldn't you
NPR.
Also say, I mean, I'm not sure how much I would grant that NPR is way to the left or anything. I, on balance, I guess, yes, left to center. But leaving that aside, wouldn't you say that NPR is at a somewhat higher intellectual level than Rush Limbaugh, or would you not?
Than Limbaugh, I'm not sure. Maybe than other talk radio outlets, maybe so. But
say like
I don't know,
Michael
but, you know,
Savage or something.
Oh, certainly, yes, yeah.
Well, that's well part of the right wing, you know, talk radio lineup, you know, consists of a certain amount of, you know, crude, you know.
But I mean, I think you're confusing. You know, when you listen to NPR, when a liberal listens to NPR, I think NPR is kind of like a warm bath of affirmation for everything you believe, and indeed it is not said and usually not conducted in a really confrontational manner. You know, they probably, you know, what was that book called, The Republican War on Science? I mean, they would do features that would tell you that the Republicans are conducting a war on science, but they wouldn't be really ugly about it. But it, so it's this kind of warm bath of affirmation for all of your liberal ideas. Certainly Limbaugh would be a similar thing, but it's more of a, you know, of a cold rush. I mean, people,
yeah,
it's just a much more entertaining thing. But in terms of substance, you know, I think Limbaugh gets a lot of information out.
I guess it seems to me that, I mean, don't you think the average word uttered on NPR has more syllables than the average word uttered?
Well, what does that matter? I mean, you know, how many times have you heard an idea conveyed better? You know, you've heard some person do like I'm doing right now and take a bunch of words to describe something, and some other person does it in three words.
Yeah, I'm kind of
joking.
Which
is more intellectual? You know?
I'm kind of being the zany guy I am. I was kind of joking, but only halfway. I mean, I do think that the level of it is at least, you're right, there is a difference between pitching your message to a highly educated group and doing truly kind of cerebral in the sense of analytically good stuff. Those are not the same thing. But I would say at a minimum, NPR is kind of catering to a more educated audience.
See, I think you could argue that NPR, in its role as affirmer, doesn't really challenge people's thoughts most of the time.
I mean, I'm not a huge NPR fan, let me tell you. I listen to the BBC in the morning, and you probably don't like the BBC's politics or something, but if you just compare the interview styles and how acute the interviews themselves are in terms of forcing whoever you're talking to get to you know, getting really to the meat of the issue through an interview, don't you think the BBC is clearly superior to NPR?
No, they have two things that are superior. One is that, which is their British sort of style of debating and not letting people not answer questions.
Right.
And the other is, generally, I think they have longer sound bites. They let people complete their sentence. And this is more than just the American television media do. I will say one tiny thing from the Carl Bernstein book on Hillary. I think it was that one. I reviewed both of those books. I think when she was in Arkansas, Bernstein reported that she never read the papers. She liked to listen to NPR each morning. So it gave her everything she needed to know.
A warm bath of affirmation, you might say.
A warm bath of affirmation, yes.
The you know, my final little gripe about NPR, a recent example, it was this Gaza stuff was breaking, and it was there were like two or three days in a row where there were really big stories out of Gaza. First, it's like, okay, this is a civil war, and then one day it was like, okay, Hamas has taken over. And I think this was the morning that it was like Hamas had taken over. But anyway, what the NPR news led with was five American soldiers killed in Iraq yesterday. Now, that's like 1.2 more than the average day in Iraq or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not even a story. And, you know, there was, and I guess you might attribute that to liberal bias, but anyway, I mean, what was going on in Gaza was truly important, you know, and what was going on in Iraq was another day in a war that we know we're in.
You know, in the news business, and I was in television news for a few years, you know, you got to lead with something, and I'm sure NPR reported the Gaza stuff, and it sounds to me like Gaza on that day probably was a better lead, but it's not something I'd get all agitated about.
The way I just did.
The way you just did. I mean, and the other thing is, I have to admit, it sounds terrible to say you know, five American troops died in Iraq. Big deal, because obviously it is a big deal.
No, it is, of course, a big deal. But you know, from a news perspective, news is what you're not expecting.
That's right. So I can understand saying that Gaza on that day was the bigger lead story. But
I thought you would welcome the opportunity to say, yes, that's those liberals at NPR reminding us of what Bush has gotten us into in Iraq. But you did not. You did not seize that opportunity, Byron.
I was just speaking as a news producer, saying, you know, you got to start with something. And yeah. I would be more irritated if a story had actually been left out of the newscast or grossly underplayed. And my guess is Gaza probably.
No, they did go on to actually spend more time on it. Okay.
I'm not going to get agitated and criticize NPR.
Yeah, but anyway, you can better be BBC-led with Gaza that day.
Yeah.
So, okay, I don't know. We've been doing this almost exactly an hour, and
really?
I think we've left no stone unturned.
It's just flown by.
Yeah. how that happens when you get older.
I know. Well, listen, I hope I get an opportunity again sometime to actually do this with the founder and CEO of Blogging Heads. It's been a great honor.
And I hope I once again get the opportunity to do it with someone who's been on Meet the Press not once but twice.
And now you're going to think about these marketing revenue ideas that I gave you, right?
I'll tell you, the whole concept of revenue is such a radical one that I'm still kind of regaining my equilibrium.
Well,
You
needed a capitalist, a conservative, to come on and suggest to you that if you're going to start a business, you might actually want to make money.
I knew when the good ideas of that sort came along, they would come from the right, Byron. And I really appreciate your market orientation, man.
I just hope you'll listen. Thank you.
And when your ideas pay off, the check will be in the mail, okay?
I'm waiting for it. Good
okay.
Well,
you're going to keep waiting, too. All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
See you around.